Imagine you're on call. A woman in her third trimester is admitted with acute severe ulcerative colitis. She has already failed multiple advanced therapies. Intravenous steroids are not working. Surgery is becoming a real possibility. And the medication most likely to induce remission is one our current guidelines is generally recommend avoiding during pregnancy. What do you do?
Welcome back to Behind the Case, the ACG Case Reports Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Yash Shah, Gastroenterology Fellow at University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, and also the Associate Editor for the ACG Case Reports Journal. Joining me is my co-host, Dr. Arjun Chatterjee, who is a third-year fellow at Cleveland Clinic, and also the Chief Editor of ACG Case Reports Journal. And our guest expert today is Dr. Lauren Rabinowitz. Dr. Rabinowitz is an Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and an attending physician in the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She is also the founder and director of the P2P IBD Clinic, a dedicated multidisciplinary clinic focusing entirely on the care of IBD patients from preconception to postpartum. On a personal note, Dr. Rabinowitz was my first GI mentor through the ACG mentorship program, making it especially meaningful to have her as a guest on the podcast today. Welcome, Dr. Rabinowitz, to the podcast.
Thank you both so much for having me, and I'm thrilled to have an opportunity to talk about IBD and pregnancy.
Thank you, Yash, and thank you, Dr. Rabinowitz. I am Arjun. So today's discussion centers on the recently published case, upadacitinib as a rescue therapy in pregnant patients with inflammatory bowel disease, which was featured in the ACC Case Reports Journal. While the case highlights the successful use of upadacitinib during pregnancy, what really caught our attention is the broader high-stakes clinical dilemma it raises.
It's sadly urgent. I think every gastroenterologist who treats patients with inflammatory bowel disease has encountered a version of this situation. Your patient finally achieves remission after months or even years of cycling through different advanced therapies. Then she becomes pregnant or encounters a severe flare during pregnancy. Suddenly, the question is no longer just what's the most effective medication for this colitis. It's what is the safest, fastest intervention to protect both the mother and the baby. When standard options fail, there isn't a textbook answer.
Absolutely, Yash. When it comes to managing severe refractory flares in pregnancy, it really feels like we're expecting the unexpected, but we always hope our advanced therapies deliver.
Exactly. Puns aside, the only thing that should be universally shared in these complex scenarios isn't necessarily a specific medication. It's the critical multidisciplinary decision-making. To set the stage, let's look at the actual clinical presentation from the article. The case involved a 34-year-old female, G4P4004, with left-sided ulcerative colitis diagnosed in 2018. Crucially, her historical disease pattern showed that her flares were recurrently evoked and exacerbated by her pregnancies. She had already cycled through and failed multiple advanced mechanisms, including anti-tumor necrosis factor therapies and interleukin-12/23 inhibition. During her fourth pregnancy, everything was stable until 26 weeks, when she developed severe urgency and bloody diarrhea. By 27 weeks and 5 days, she required hospitalization for intravenous methylprednisolone. A bedside flexible sigmoidoscopy confirmed severe Mayo grade 3 colitis extending to the left colon. Dr. Rabinowitz, when you hear this presentation, what immediately concerns you?
You know, I think that's a great question. And, you know, Arjun, to your earlier point, we really try to understand the patient as an individual. Certainly for this patient, thinking about her prior history of flaring during pregnancy made us somewhat concerned for this pregnancy that she was going to become more sick again. I think it's where it's really also important to understand what the data tells us about what medications are reasonable to reach for, so that we can have informed decision-making conversations, not only with our patients, but also with the whole team of people taking care of a high-risk pregnancy like this one. So for example, in this patient's case, the GI team, the maternal fetal medicine or high-risk OBGYN team, as well as our colleagues in colorectal surgery as well.
one thing that really struck me about this case was that it wasn't simply a patient who accidentally became pregnant while taking a JAK inhibitor. This was an intentional acute salvage medical decision made at 28 weeks to avoid an imminent surgical colectomy. Given that upadacitinib is a small molecule that crosses placenta via passive diffusion, how do you frame the risk-benefit counseling to a patient and maternal-fetal medicine, the MFM team, when human pregnancy registry data is still emerging?
I think that's a really great question, Arjun, and I think it's one that's going to become increasingly relevant, right? You know, we have an armamentarium of medications available for us to use in people with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and that is only expected to explode in the next 5 to 10 years and beyond. So we are more increasingly frequently going to be operating in the gray, right? Nobody wants to do randomized control trials on pregnant women and their offspring. But what that means is that oftentimes the data in these patients, and by the way, these patients are coming to us, whether they're included in the randomized clinical trials or not. But the data for pregnancy is always slightly lagging, of course, the data for its safety and use and efficacy in the general population. So I think it's a couple of different considerations. One is, when is this patient becoming pregnant and how do we set that patient up for success? And I would argue that those conversations that happen early on are more important than any other conversation, because it's really important for our patients to understand the safety of their current medical therapy through pregnancy and postpartum, but then also to figure out how we're going to troubleshoot. And I like to have those conversations with my patients as early as possible also. You know, flaring can happen. We try to set people up for success by ensuring that they're in deep remission 3 to 6 months, ideally before they conceive. But things can happen, and it's always important to have a good game plan in place and to communicate that game plan for how we manage flares in pregnancy to patients before they happen. The other thing that I think is really important as gastroenterologists is that we're armed with this information and we have access to the data, however limited, but our colleagues in other subspecialties may not have that access. And so taking the time to do education with our colleagues in OBGYN, colorectal surgery, et cetera, primary care, is really valuable because it helps to reinforce the messaging. So when we have these conversations with patients, even before they become pregnant, that we're all on the same page and we're all delivering the same message to that patient, no matter from which angle we are providing care, whether that be GI, OBGYN, et cetera.
Those are excellent points. That distinction regarding gestational timing is a critical takeaway for all the fellows. Now, as we transition to tracking these high-stakes patients, we want to maximize our objective tracking while minimizing invasive procedures. Given your focus on non-invasive monitoring in the P2P clinic, what is the clinical role of point-of-care intestinal ultrasound in a pregnant patient? How can it complement or even replace tools like serial flexible sigmoidoscopy or fecal calprotectin protecting when managing an active flare?
Yash, I think that's such a great point. You know, intestinal ultrasound is becoming an increasingly available tool, at least in expert centers. That is incredibly valuable because it's safe and effective, and it doesn't involve any invasive procedures or exposure to anesthetic. I will say that not every gastroenterologist or gastroenterology practice in the country has access to intestinal ultrasound, although that may change in the next decade or so. However, it can be a really valuable tool. It does have some limitations, particularly in later pregnancy, where visualization of the bowel may be impaired by the gravid uterus, but certainly has significant diagnostic value, particularly in the first and second trimesters. The other piece of this is that we shouldn't be afraid to scope patients, particularly if we're not sure what the diagnosis is or we're trying to understand severity, because severity can actually oftentimes guide what the treatment strategy is for a patient who's flaring. So, you know, again, while we try to avoid proceduralizing patients unless there is real diagnostic yield, it is not uncommon that we need to scope a patient during pregnancy, particularly if we're not sure whether they have IBD or not, or we're not sure how sick they are. And that's true regardless of the timing. If there's any way to move those procedures beyond the first trimester, we try to do that if we can, but sometimes we can't. And certainly thinking about an unsedated flexible sigmoidoscopy early in pregnancy, if it really will change management, can be valuable.
This is fantastic. Thank you for sharing all those clinical vignettes, Dr. Rabinowitz. From a trainee perspective, one of the hardest things is recognizing when you have to practice outside the comfort zone of standard published guidelines. How often do you see these highly refractory scenarios actually arise in a tertiary IVD practice?
I think it's not uncommon, right? You know, IVD is most frequently diagnosed in the second and third decade of life, which means that many patients are diagnosed or navigating early diagnosis when they may be more ill at the same time that they're also considering or in the middle of biologic pregnancy or lactation. And so it's not uncommon. In fact, I was on service last week with my week two fellows, and we scoped two pregnant patients just on Friday. It happens. And so being prepared and comfortable operating outside of the guidelines is important, but it's also really important that you know the data and you understand what the guidelines say, so that you have a frame of reference within which to be operating. The other thing I will say is that people in expert centers tend to be incredibly generous with their knowledge and their expertise. We're all very lucky, especially when you're training. You are, by virtue of being a trainee, in a place where medical education is actively happening. But even beyond that, I never mind if someone in the community who I've worked with previously or who I don't even know reaches out to me because they're concerned about what to do for a highly complicated patient. In fact, it's an honor to be a trusted colleague. So I would say it happens frequently. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Make sure you do know what the guidelines say and work with your patients and with your teams where you are to make sure that you're making the best decision for your patient and with your patient.
Thank you, Dr. Rabinowitz. That's a great point, and it's definitely helpful to reach out early for help for the best outcomes. Dr. Rabinowitz, taking a step back, if this exit patient presented to your clinic today in 2026, would you make the same clinical treatment decision? Has our real-world evidence base changed enough since this case was managed to alter your framework?
Yeah, so I think that's a great point. The answer is that the data remains limited in human use cases, but we do have 80 trial and 48 post-market cases. This was a study that was published in 2024 by Uma Mahadevan, who was a UCSF, an absolute pioneer in this space of IBD and pregnancy. Those cases were mostly in patients who were diagnosed as pregnant and then the medicine was stopped very early on. But importantly, despite the fact that we know that JAK inhibitors cross the placenta early via passive diffusion, there were no first trimester teratogenicity signals, which I think is really valuable. Certainly, we're still counseling patients that they should be stopping JAK inhibitors approximately 4 weeks prior to planned conception and that they avoid lactation for now, again, because we're still not clear on the pharmacokinetics and safety during lactation as well. But I would say that it's really important to be making these case-based decisions. And the other thing for this particular patient is that she was well beyond the point of organogenesis, which is completed at approximately 8 weeks of gestation. In the second and third trimester, again, the stakes are sometimes feeling lower because that teratogenicity risk is decreased. You know, the baby has already been fully formed and is at that point obviously growing and becoming more mature. But the later in pregnancy that these medications are reached for, we think the lower the risk to the growing fetus. So I think it just highlights a couple of things, which is how do you set a patient up for success if they're already taking a JAK inhibitor and are planning pregnancy? And how do we manage a flare in a highly medically refractory patient who's already nearing the third trimester, where now you're just trying to decrease the risk of delivery complications? And I think the overarching point here is that active inflammatory bowel disease itself drives obstetric and fetal risk, including preterm birth and low birth weights, as well as NICU admissions. So we really tend to think that maternal control outweighs theoretical drug risks in these types of cases. Again, really important to be doing shared decision-making with your patient, but also to be carefully considering how sick they are and where they are in the process.
Thank you for sharing this incredibly valuable clinical perspective. Definitely thinking about the fetal outcomes is also very important in someone who has an active flare during pregnancy. Looking ahead over the next decade, what do you think are the biggest remaining unanswered questions regarding newer small molecules and advanced therapies in pregnancy?
That's a great question, Yash. And you know, I think one of the things that we've really learned, again, from the work being done by Dr. Mahadevan, Dr. Marla Dubinsky, Dr. Sananda Kane, Dr. Millie Long, and other real pioneers in this space of pregnancy and inflammatory bowel disease, is we have a very good understanding now, thanks to their incredible work and efforts over almost now two decades, understanding how the biologics work in pregnancy. and the idea that biologics, by virtue of being large molecules, really don't have much placental transfer until the second trimester and then really in the third trimester of pregnancy. That is in contrast to small molecule therapies, which do cross the placenta early via passive diffusion. So, you know, even thinking about the type of therapy and how likely the developing fetus is to be exposed to it is an important conversation to have, especially when we're considering reaching for newer therapies. For example, some of the IL-23s, risankizumab, mirikizumab, guselkumab, the data still remains somewhat limited, although that's changing very quickly. But, you know, we always want to make sure that we understand the principles of how these therapies work and the likelihood that the developing fetus will even be exposed to it in early pregnancy before we start having these counseling conversations. The better question is that we're going to be seeing new and different mechanisms of action targeting Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And increasingly, we're actually using advanced therapies in combination, right? Patients who require a TNF therapy and also require an IL-23, or patients who need a JAK inhibitor in addition to an IL-23 therapy or an anti-integrin, and trying to think about how we manage those patients who really have required a multiple mechanistic approach, and thinking about how we get them safely through family planning if that's what they desire. The other thing, and this is not what the purpose or focus of this podcast is, but I just want to flag it, is that these conversations also impact your male patients. You know, we think a lot about family planning and female patients and thinking about how to set patients up for pregnancy and postpartum. But a lot of our male patients have questions in these spaces as well. So important not to forget about the fact that male fertility is also important to consider and important to counsel patients about.
Thank you, Yash, for asking Dr. Rabinowitz all the difficult questions. I had another question for you, Dr. Rabinowitz. For those of us still in training, are there any specific educational resources that you recommend for us to stay up to date with the data on the intersection of IBD and pregnancy?
Arjun, I think that's such a fantastic question, especially because the data is changing all of the time. And the answer is, you know, the best way to learn is to learn from your patients, especially since, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in a large hospital to train, whether that be community-based or academic, you're going to see a lot if you're willing to see a lot and use your patients as an opportunity to learn and to read deeply. For example, this conversation today really sort of focuses on a patient who was exposed to a JAK inhibitor, having failed multiple other therapies. So I would argue that, you know, that's, again, an edge case. And thinking about how we manage patients and set them up for success really starts in the preconception conversations that we have in the clinic every single day. So the best way to learn is to learn from patients. If you can see patients with inflammatory bowel disease where you are, that's fantastic. I will also say that staying on top of the guidelines, you know, we're talking about what happens when the guidelines don't apply to the individual in front of you. You only know that if you read the guidelines. And the data is changing all the time, and the guidelines are changing all the time as well. The 2025 International Consensus Statement is an extremely important document that highlighted the work being done by phenomenal researchers all over the world. I think it's important to stay on top of the guidelines for a number of different reasons. First of all, it offers you a framework for thinking about how to manage patients safely. And I also think it really, it alerts you to who's doing the important work in these spaces. As I mentioned, nobody minds if we hear about patients and we can be helpful, even if they're outside of our own centers. And it's really important to understand who's doing the work in those spaces, especially if you come across a patient and you're not sure what to do. Read, read, read. The more you can read and the more you can listen to your patients, the better prepared you're going to be to take care of anything that comes your way.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rabinowitz. You have definitely focused on a lot of important points, especially also taking care of our male patients who have IBD and are planning for a family. I would love to finish with a practical high-yield take-home point for our listeners. If a GI fellow remembers only one core principle from today's discussion, what would that be?
I think it's to make sure you're taking care of the individual in front of you. If you don't understand what's important to your patient, it's very hard to help them to make decisions about their body and their health. For this particular patient, she had 4 pregnancies. All of them were complicated by IBD flares, and yet she continued to feel it was important for her to have more children. And so taking that into consideration and understanding who this person was and what was going to be feasible for her in terms of treatment strategies really guided the medical decision-making. I think the importance of putting your patient in the center and really deeply knowing who that person is and trying to understand as best as you can as a physician, what is important to that individual, really helps us to understand the guidelines and how to apply them to the individual patient. Again, sometimes people are so sick, it's so complicated, the guidelines may not apply. But even in this patient's case, you know, this is a person who really wanted to have more children. She understood that the pregnancy could be high risk. She had several high risk pregnancies prior to this pregnancy. And she was also very adamant that she attempt to avoid invasive procedures, like, for example, a colectomy, as of course most patients would prefer to avoid, especially during a pregnancy. So she was comfortable with us making the recommendation to try a medication that has data limitations. And it ended up being quite successful for her and also for her baby. So again, thinking about who the person is and how important understanding who your patient is gonna allow you to make those good decisions together with your patient.
This has been a fantastic discussion. Thank you, Dr. Rabinowitz. Thank you so much for your time, your valuable clinical insight and expertise, these practice insights that you shared with us today. This case beautifully highlights that while randomized evidence may be limited in pregnancy, thoughtful multidisciplinary collaboration and swift intervention can deliver fantastic outcomes for both mother as well as child.
We highly encourage all of our listeners to read the full case report, Uptazetinib as a Rescue Therapy in Pregnant Patient with IBD, published in the ACG Case Reports Journal, where you will find additional details about the patient's exact clinical timeline and a concise review of the literature. Thank you again, Dr. Rabinowitz, and thanks to everyone listening. Until next time, I'm Dr. Yash Shah.
And I'm Dr. Arjun Chatterjee. Thank you for listening to our podcast, Behind the Case.